the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program.
Friends and enemies, welcome to yet another edition of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. I'm Len. I'll be doing this one solo. Joey has the night off after doing a wonderful job yesterday interviewing Luke. So thank you, Joey, for doing your part, and now I'm going to do mine. But before we go any further, we have Natalie on standby ready to come in. But before I bring her into the show, I just want to read off a couple of things. Number one, we are sponsored by EasyDNS. It's a great place for anything related to Anycast, domain name registration, web and email hosting, virtual private servers. They got that covered. NIP05 got that as well. They did have a Nostr Relay. So if you were on the Nostr Relay list, you just have to contact them because then you'll be whitelisted to continue using their Nostr Relay. They also, if you're looking to move over your email services and your web hosting services over to them, you could use their migration service. They'll help you out. It's a very simple process, and they have a great team able to help you out. They're fast, privacy focused, and you could also pay with Bitcoin. How good is that? But use the code CBPMedia, and that's going to get you 50% off your initial purchase. So it's going to be really helpful if you are moving over. But second, we do have another sponsor. In fact, I'm wearing their shirt, Bull Bitcoin. Thank you for providing this shirt. And it's a great place to get your Bitcoin KYC or KYC free. That's my recommendation. It's very simple to do. I did a video on that not too long ago. You can live on the Bitcoin standard by using Bull Bitcoin because you could buy your Bitcoin over there, but you could also sell your Bitcoin, buy gift cards, pay your bills, the whole nine yards, Liquid, Lightning, they got it all. So check it out. Use our referral code below. If you sign up by doing that, you'll get $20 added to your account. 20 or 21. We always have debates about this on the show with Joey. But either way, you'll be ahead of the game by using our code. But without further ado, let's bring on Natalie Smolensky. Because you know what? People are here to see her, not me. Because I'm just a jabroni here every week. And Natalie has a lot more to talk about than I do. A lot more, valid stuff than I do. Natalie, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good evening. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it certainly is. Thanks for coming on and agreeing to come on our show. You've been on so many shows over the last... You're very well known in the Bitcoin sphere. So having you come on our show is absolutely phenomenal. So I want to thank you very much for doing so. But I guess for like the one person living under a rock, though, does not know who you are, just give us a rundown how it is you came to Bitcoin. And you know, a lot of people have different paths, different ways of figuring it out. I want to hear your story with Bitcoin.
Yeah, sure. So in a past life, I was an anthropologist and historian working on, you know, questions of religion, value, sanctity. I ended up making a transition into the private sector. And specifically, I worked at a software firm that incubated the first Bitcoin-based digital identity wallet in partnership with MIT. So I got into Bitcoin actually through the digital identity side more than the currency side. That spawned basically a decade of entrepreneurship, had the first Bitcoin company exit, arguably. I continue to work in enterprise software while also leading the Texas Bitcoin Foundation, which is a 501c3 institution dedicated to research and education about Bitcoin. We are currently working on a project called the Satoshi Papers, which will be our first book. It's an investigation of political economy in the 21st century in light of Bitcoin. So it's the first kind of scholarly journal that brings together contributions from various disciplines on the topic of Bitcoin and society.
It's the Texas Bitcoin Foundation. You helped found this.
Yes.
When was this founded? Because I want to go down this rabbit hole.
Yeah. So we officially launched in January of 2022. So we're very young. Previously, before I launched the foundation, I co-founded the Texas Blockchain Council, which is a C6 trade association, meaning that, you know, we advocate for the blockchain industry in Texas. I wanted to do something with more of a Bitcoin focus. Bitcoin was part of the council's portfolio, but I felt like in the rush to do policy work, we often don't step back and look at the bigger picture of like, what theory or models of government are we functioning from? Like, for example, there's this kind of common wisdom that we need more regulation in the crypto space, quote unquote, or more regulation of Bitcoin. That may not in fact be true. And so this gets to, you know, what is the optimal role of government, the relationship between government and society, how does money play into that? And these are like social scientific questions. These are philosophical questions, questions of political economy. And so I felt like there was kind of a gap in the Bitcoin world where no one was really writing that stuff. And I felt that's where I could probably make a singular contribution.
The Satoshi papers. Let's talk about this. Is it going to be a very, very lot of pages? Is it going to be a novella? who's involved with writing this? I want to know a little bit more about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a set of articles by like 5-6 contributors. Where we all have different scholarly backgrounds. So some of us are, you know, economists, others are historians. I'm, you know, an anthropologist. And so each person is kind of writing about a different aspect of Bitcoin from their own background and point of view, but it's rigorous research. So it's, you know, it's not a blog post. It's something that will be cited by policy papers, by future research, and that really serves as a kind of touchstone to this moment in hyper-Bitcoinization.
Is this something that's going to be presented to, say, lawmakers or regulators to maybe help them usher in a new era? Or, I'm curious, have you been invited by the White House or anybody, any other big parties over there, big wigs over there that could help present this and to just inform them what's going on with the Satoshi papers?
Yeah. So I'm actually, in addition to my work at the foundation, I'm a senior fellow at the Bitcoin Policy Institute, which is also a nonprofit organization focused more on the policy conversation around Bitcoin. So I spoke at the Bitcoin Policy Summit in Washington earlier this year. I briefed Congress on CBDCs. I authored a white paper on why the United States should reject central bank digital currencies for the BPI. And so that is one avenue of direct engagement with the policy community. Another avenue is through direct education of lawmakers and policymakers. So, you know, I have relationships with legislators. I'll often just talk to them. I've, you know, spoken to various state Senate subcommittees and committees in the state of Texas to help drive legislation there. So there's definitely an engagement that I have with policy, but this is like zoomed out.
Mm-hmm. in terms of, well, I guess one person that is heavily involved with creating regulations, I'm getting with Bitcoin, Gary Gensler. Yeah. Why don't you hear your thoughts about him? Because it seems that no matter what, we're going to have to deal with him in one way or another, given his position. But he has an interesting past too, because he does he had exposure to Bitcoin and what it is and the fundamentals of it before he took his position at the chair of the SEC. So what are your thoughts on him, and what do you think might be his future moves moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think Gensler gets it in the sense that he understands that the innovation in the crypto space is Bitcoin. This is what he was teaching at MIT back in 2018. He's like, Satoshi Nakamoto's innovation is sound. And he's even telling this class, like, if you don't currently own Bitcoin, why not? So he's, I think he truly understands. And I think his point of view is that other cryptos are overwhelmingly unregistered securities. The challenge with Gensler is that his professional incentives are at odds with his scientific judgment. And so he has been carrying water for various regulatory agencies under the presupposition that empowering those agencies with more money and more power is self-evidently a public good and self-evidently in the best interests of investors and the American people. Currently, the SEC has like a $2 billion annual budget. I mean, that's like the largest tech companies in the world, you know, have similar operating expenses. And for all of that budget, how many scams in the cryptoverse have they actually succeeded in protecting investors from? I would suggest few to zero. They tend to be late, they come in after the fact, and they don't make any actual judgments about what constitutes a security in this space. And so even something as simple as the Howey test, which is established by precedent, isn't being used. And so all of this suggests to me that Gensler's long-term play is actually to destroy Bitcoin or to fight it, because at the end of the day, he's a statist. And so he views Bitcoin as, unlike all of these shitcoins, as the only real credible threat to the absolute dominance of the US dollar. And so as much as he's a Bitcoin maximalist in the crypto universe, at the end of the day, in the money universe, he's a US dollar maximalist. And that's what he's going to put his career behind.
I'd like to think he has at least a shred of capitalism in him that maybe want to see this thing succeed in one way, shape, or form. But is there any pressure that is coming from the White House that is guiding his decisions? He's not doing, or the SEC is not doing this within a vacuum. There has to be some pressure from beyond the SEC that is pushing them in the direction that they're going. Is that not the case?
Absolutely. So, you know, if you're a career regulator, your goal is to continue to be appointed in, you know, similar or higher prestige roles at other regulatory agencies when your tenure at one of them comes to an end. Either that or to transition sort of in a cushy way into the private sector. But the types of private sector institutions that regulators tend to go work for tend to be, you know, like governments in terms of their scale, their capitalization, and their influence. And so everything from a professional incentive standpoint is incentivizing you to please whatever administration is in power, to not rock the boat, and to not alienate whatever potential future administration could be in power. And so resolutely refusing to make a decision or provide regulatory guidance about what a security is like the ultimate form of playing it safe from a career standpoint. We can't make anybody mad. You know, nobody really understands this. You know, neither Republican nor Democratic administrations, you know, have a really good grasp of this area. And so the safest thing for me to probably do is nothing for a very long period of time.
I think that doing nothing going forward is going to really hurt them, because they are slowly losing the battle. The US dollar, it's had its, you know, the sun is setting on it, and it's no longer has the same sort of dominance it had in the past. And it's not strictly because of Bitcoin. It's a whole number of different factors, right, too. But I just want to transition a little bit, because one of the things that is slowly being introduced is FedNow. And I want to hear your thoughts about this, because we talk about this in the show as this may be a prelude to ultimately a rollout of a CBDC. But I want to hear your thoughts on the Fed now and what role it's going to be playing and how it may impact the streamlining of moving money around in between institutions, banks, countries, and so forth. So, yeah, go on. I want to hear what you think about Fed now.
So FedNow is just a real-time settlement system for the U.S. controlled correspondent banking system. So it's just a faster way of settling transactions between banks. You know, it's not the infrastructure that has been proposed for a CBDC. That is actually a different set of pilots and technology architectures that are being built. You know, FedNow it's kind of necessary, you know, for the U.S. banking global system to compete, because other banking systems already have real-time settlement in other parts of the world. You know, blockchains now, you know, depending on what architectures you're using, have either real-time or close to real-time settlement. So the fact that you still have to wait, you know, 24 hours or, you know, however long it takes to settle money in the US system is a really antiquated technology. I mean, this was built, I believe, back in the 70s or something. So it's really due for an upgrade. The problem isn't the convenience of real-time settlement that FedNow provides. It's almost like a red herring. Like the real issue is around programmable money and the degree of granular control that provides the state. And I would suggest that the groundwork for CBDCs was laid successively across many U.S. administrations and Congresses, arguably beginning with the Bank Secrecy Act in 1970, through things like the Right to Financial Privacy Act of 1978, which was nothing of the sort, it was the exact opposite, to, you know, things like the Patriot Act more recently, which put the final nail in the coffin of the Fourth Amendment in effect. So a CBDC is just a logical extension of the surveillance power that banks and governments already have over every aspect of your financial life.
Yeah, it's going to get worse. I mean, the way it is right now, everybody saw what happened in Canada with what happened in Ottawa earlier in 2022. And that was done with just a stroke of a pen, but it could be done much more easy and much more targeted if there's ever a rollout of a CBDC that actually works. And that's something that I have questions that if they have the capability of actually rolling it out and making it work to the extent that they want to. But yeah. Project Hamilton, you're familiar with this, I would imagine. I mean, I've watched a lot of videos about this. They're very forthcoming with exactly what they're trying to achieve here in terms of the rollout of the technology. But is this a lot of smoke? Is this just a distraction more than anything? Or do you think Project Hamilton, actually there's some legitimacy to this for the way they want to roll out a CBDC?
Oh, absolutely. So there are CBDC pilots and even some live implementations already in various countries around the world. The Human Rights Foundation recently rolled out a CBDC tracker that allows you to see, you know, to monitor the progress of CBDCs around the world. So these are very real. They will be implemented. The degree of, you know, success and reliability remains to be seen. It, you know, to date has varied widely from one project to the next. But I mean, there are blue chip companies competing for these contracts, because of course no government is actually going to build it themselves. They're going to contract out to software providers to build the infrastructure. And so in the US, I mean, Amazon, AWS, and Accenture have really been at the forefront of making a market for their blockchain services to build CBDCs.
In terms of the execution of that, and if it's ever rolled out for retail, because I don't think that we're going to be seeing this for even on a pilot scale for quite some time. The way I understand it, they'll probably do it more in the back end. It will be through facilitating transfer of monies for between country to country, or even from central bank to commercial bank. So we're still a long time away from seeing a retail CBDC in United States and Canada. Am I correct?
Well, I don't know what the law looks like in Canada, but in the United States, it would require an act of Congress to roll out a retail CBDC. That said, there is momentum in the Congress to do that. There's also momentum against it. What is more likely to happen, though, is that the U.S. government will roll out a wholesale CBDC first. That's not a retail CBDC, which enables bank-to-bank settlement. So it'll basically be a competitor alternative to FedNow, using distributed ledgers or similar technologies. And then because that's bank-to-bank, it doesn't require legislation. And then they're going to bake it into the banking infrastructure. And so at some point, Congress is going to be like, well, if we have a bank-to-bank CBDC, then why can't American citizens use it? Like, that's dumb. Like, we should roll it out to the people. And so suddenly you're going to, you know, open your Bank of America or Citi or Chase account. You're going to see that you have a CBDC account because they're going to roll it out through the commercial bank. So you're not going to have an account directly with the Federal Reserve. You'll have it with your, you know, with your current bank, but it will all be back-ended and can now be directly controlled by the Fed or the Treasury or both.
In terms of the political candidates that are vying to become president of the United States, few of them have been talking favorably about Bitcoin, but have they also made any reference to CBDCs? That maybe RFK Jr. did, but has anybody else made any reference whatsoever to CBDCs?
That's a good question. I think Tulsi Gabbard may have, but it's not, you know, CBDCs aren't an issue that the major political parties, either party, is particularly concerned with. It's not something that they see as, you know, being able to really mobilize voters for them. So it hasn't been a major talking point.
Yeah. Somebody mentioned DeSantis is against him. And yes, I recall that he's.
Yes. DeSantis, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of it ever is ruled out, what happens to commercial banks at that point? Because right now they're able to operate in the current system and they're able to benefit from that with their master account with the Fed, and they're able to pass on the interests to the clients, to their customers, and they're middle people and they're reaping the rewards from all this. But in a rollout of a CBDC where money is issued directly from the central bank, what is the role of commercial banks? Are they going to be amalgamating a lot of them, so there's going to be a small number of them moving forward? I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, we've already seen a progressive consolidation of the commercial banking system, where many of the smaller banks are going out of business or being absorbed into larger banks. This is part of a wider trend of the consolidation of bank and state. So the largest banks, I mean, all banks are police. They're all required by US law, international law, international financial regulatory bodies to report on their customers and to initiate enforcement actions if there's anything off pattern. The larger banks tend to, you know, benefit from their closeness to the regulatory apparatus and the revolving door between, you know, regulators and executives at those firms to entrench their status in the economic food chain. And so they benefit from, you know, things like the Cantillon effect, where they're the first to receive newly printed money, So they realize it's fuller value, and then it, you know, trickles down to everyone else, progressively devalued. So absolutely, CBDCs, a rollout of CBDCs, wholesale or retail, but particularly retail, represents a threat to commercial banking. And this has already been modeled. Like, organizations like the World Economic Forum have modeled the contraction in deposits at commercial banks as a result of CBDC rollouts. Because in effect, if, you know, if the central bank is issuing the currency directly, and they're fully, it's a, the currency is a liability of the central bank, then people, ordinary depositors, are going to want to hold their money in the safest possible bank. And that happens to be the central bank, or the banks, the commercial banks that are closest to the central bank. Absolutely. I mean, commercial banking is increasingly just becoming a government service.
Now, given that it's going to change the way commercial banking is done, there's a lot of powerful players there, lobbyists. There's a lot of money already in this system because that's their game. Don't you think that if that's the case, wouldn't they then be against any rollout of a retail CBDC because it could potentially impact their ability to profit through all this? So
yes,
wouldn't they want to stop this? And don't they have the ability to maybe create some roadblocks for lawmakers to do so?
Yes, they do. And what we've seen in the US is that the smaller banks, particularly the credit unions, have written and spoken out against CBDCs, because they're the ones who are most at risk existentially of going out of business. The big banks won't, but that's why they're going to push for the CBDC rollout to happen through them. So, you know, the largest banks are just going to, you know, be the vehicle through which CBDC accounts are administered.
I could think one way this could get proposed to the general population, to normies. And one way would be is they could come out with the idea that, or the thought that we already have digital money, because there's the idea that our money right now is digital. And there is some truth to that. It's not programmable to the same way that a CBDC is, but it is, in some way, it is digital. And they could also say that through the use of a CBDC, you could counter money laundering, you could counter the sale of drugs, and so many other ways, tax evasion. So you could use these as ways to prep normies to say, yeah, this is actually a good thing. But in the end, unfortunately, we understand what's behind the scenes, what's under the hood, and that there's a lot of surveillance without a warrant that could be included on all of this. But do you see that normies would actually start adopting this type of idea? Yeah, let's go ahead with the CBDC. Should they come up with an, you know, that the way I'm framing it? And do you think that this could be in such a way that people would actually accept it and almost demand it to be implemented?
Absolutely. So, you know, in the 90s, the one of the founders of the cypherpunk movement wrote about how the government is always going to use the four horsemen of the infocalypse to justify doing away with privacy, particularly privacy online. And, you know, there are things like terrorism, pedophilia, you know, child trafficking or human trafficking, you know, the worst kinds of possible crimes, which, you know, decent people everywhere find abhorrent, become the justifications for placing billions of people who are innocent in the surveillance dragnet. So it's basically the, what we've seen is the slow erosion of due process and constitutional protections around criminality. Everyone is now presumed guilty unless and until they're proven innocent. And this has all happened with the enthusiastic consent of many voters. I mean, the Patriot Act was massively popular in the United States. Like, if you were opposed to the Patriot Act in 2001, you were basically tarred and feathered as like a traitor. But people who were opposed to it recognized that it was the death knell of Fourth Amendment protections. And so now we get to live in the world that has been made legal to some extent, the democratic process itself.
This is why I'm going to change my name to Pablo and move to Mexico and try to fly under the radar. But did you see the recent comments by the IMF? And they're saying that they're going to try to help support any sort of cross-border payments between one country CBDC versus another country CBDC. So they're going to be there to try to facilitate payments. So it looks like even the IMF, so on a global scale, they're on board with the idea of having individual countries roll it out on their own, and they're going to be there to support it. But looking at that, it's scary because the IMF, they're obviously a very powerful organization and trying to keep a lot of countries poor at the same time. But then they could dangle this carrot for these countries that are looking for bailouts, and maybe they could ask them or forcefully tell them, look, if you guys want the next bailout and maybe on favorable terms, try implementing something like this. Here's a template, go ahead. Right. And then, yeah. So what are your thoughts on something like that? Is that feasible?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the government consensus of virtually all governments around the world, is that CBDCs will happen. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And so, you know, the multilateral organizations like the WEF, the World Bank and others, of course they're for it. These are not organizations that buck consensus. They follow and reinforce consensus. And so from their point of view, there's no downside for governments in implementing CBDCs. So we're going to see, you know, loans that are only administered in CBDCs, and you're going to have to accept, you know, the loan in CBDC form. You're going to have to distribute it in CBDC form. And so, you know, this is why having an alternative like Bitcoin is so important, because governments are going to do what they're going to do. And there is, in some places, an electoral process, and there are potentially ways to influence that, but they're very slow moving, lossy, and often they fail because of popular resistance to the consolidation of state power often doesn't have the kind of dogged persistence that state power itself does. And so while it's important that we exercise our voice and that we vote and that we, you know, run for office as Bitcoiners, it is equally important that we recognize the state isn't going to solve these problems. Bitcoin is going to solve these problems. And us building on the Bitcoin technology stack is what's going to give a lifeline to people who simply cannot fight back the encroaching tide of the state.
And staying on a global scale, I want to change gears slightly and talk about some competing currencies out there that may be coming into fruition against the US dollar. And namely, I'm looking at the BRICS nations, or maybe even something from coming directly from China. So what are your thoughts on what's going to be coming out in terms of presenting a challenge to the United States dollar for the global reserve currency? Do you think that this is going to be something we'll be seeing in the next little while? Is BRICS going to be behind it, or China? What is their role in this? Because you're heavily involved in this. I hear you talk a lot about the global economy and the world reserve status that is the United States dollar. And it seems like the sun is setting on this. So I want to hear your thoughts about what may play out in the next little while with respect to the US dollar.
Yeah. So, there are two categories of reserves. There are reserve assets and then reserve currencies. Reserve currencies tend to be, you know, the currency that things are invoiced in. So, you know, when people are paying their bills, what currency are they using? Reserve assets are, you know, assets that that comprise the asset side of the balance sheet of the central bank. And so, you know, what we've been seeing is that globally, the trend to accumulate U.S. treasuries as a reserve asset by central banks, that has tapered. And in some countries, it's decreased and continues to decrease. And whereas we've seen purchases of gold go up dramatically in some of those in some of those countries' central banks. So, you know, after the United States froze Russia's sovereign reserves, I think that was a wake-up call to many countries around the world, even allied countries, that U.S. treasuries and the U.S. dollar had become fully politicized. And so their currency wasn't, in fact, theirs. It could at any point be frozen or seized by the country that still controls the U.S.-led global financial system. And so out of necessity, alternatives have emerged, whether it's the BRICS SDR, which hasn't rolled out yet, or just alternative national currencies, yen, rubles, you know, other currencies around the world. Countries are beginning to negotiate more forcefully that when it benefits them, invoices be paid in their currency of choice. And so what we're seeing is not so much that there's going to be a new reserve currency to replace the dollar. And the dollar is still dominant, by the way, as a reserve currency. It's that we're getting into a more pluralistic world or a multipolar world, to use the terminology preferred by some political scientists, where there isn't one dominant hegemon, the United States. There are many centers of power. And depending where you are geographically, you're going to be using maybe a different reserve currency.
So what you're describing there, and very well done in doing so, it seems like Bitcoin would fit in really well in exchanging of goods on a global scale from country to country. Because in this case, it's easy to buy, it's easy to transfer, it's easy to verify, and you can't be manipulated the same way that a currency can, domestic currency can. And even gold, some may even state that gold is being manipulated. So going back to that, do you think any of these nations are stacking not only gold, but Bitcoin on their reserves?
Absolutely, yeah. I think many governments are doing it quietly. At some point, you know, it will just emerge that government X, Y, or Z has been stockpiling Bitcoin and has this many Bitcoin in its sovereign reserves. So, you know, from a geopolitical strategy standpoint, my main recommendation for the U.S. government is to stockpile Bitcoin. It's the new gold, but it has many, as you pointed out, material advantages over gold. The challenge with Bitcoin for governments is that they can't control the monetary policy, and they can't program the utilization of the coin. So it is a peer-to-peer, censorship-resistant digital currency. You don't need financial intermediaries to transact with Bitcoin. And so it's gonna take time before governments openly embrace Bitcoin, but there will come a point where it's just inevitable.
The countries right now that don't have their own currency and are using a United States dollar domestically, or even have their own, but it's a fairly, fairly weak or extremely weak currency, those are the ones that don't have the ability to control very much with monetary policy because just the situation they're in. So I can see, like, a la El Salvador picking up Bitcoin and adding it to their balance sheet. But then if you get another nation, say Russia or China, Iran, even North Korea, if they start stacking Bitcoin and it's known and it's then leaked out and it's verifiable that they do it, the United States then, are they in a position to say, because our enemy is stacking it, we're not going to, because it's going to only strengthen them if we do so. So they would basically draw a line in the sand and say, Bitcoin is for our enemies, but not for us. So then it becomes very political. What do you think in that situation? Would they potentially buy still? Or do you think that they would say, no, because our enemies are doing it, we want to do everything that they're not doing? So yeah, what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, that's been the standard political narrative, you know, since Bitcoin's inception. Like, this is money for criminals. This is money for, you know, people doing terrible things and trying to cover it up. And so, like, of course, you know, the government, that, you know, bastion of righteousness, would never dirty itself by using this currency. This is why when you know, the Department of Justice seizes Bitcoin in the United States, it auctions it off. But it's not able to do that fast enough. And so it still has the largest stockpile of Bitcoin of any government in the world, just like purely accidentally. And so, I mean, that is the narrative. You know, it's the bad guys like the North Koreans that are using Bitcoin. It just doesn't matter. It's a superior technology. And so, like, you can fight against a superior technology all you want, but at the end of the day, you're going to be using it.
The funny thing is, they have, as you mentioned, a large stockpile of Bitcoin through seizures. But every time they sell it, the United States government, they sell their Bitcoin. They use Coinbase. And they just recently sued an SEC. It's not truly, it's a branch of the United States government. But it's funny that one branch is selling it, and another one is demonizing it. So yeah, you're getting it from both sides of the fence. But anyways, I just want, we're getting up to the end of this interview. I just wanted to end things off at that note. But yeah, before we sign off, just want to pass over the baton to you. Where can people find you? What's going to be happening with you in the next little while? The floor is yours, because I just want to make sure people are aware to follow you moving forward.
Absolutely. So I'm on Twitter at nsmolensky. You can also find my website if you just Google Texas Bitcoin Foundation. And there's a link at the top there to the Satoshi Papers. So that's, you know, that's really the project that I'm going to be focused on for the foreseeable future. I will be at Lugano Plan B in Switzerland. So that's kind of my next big Bitcoin event, if you happen to be there in the fall. But yeah, otherwise, you know, feel free to ping me on Twitter or reach out through my website.
SatoshiPapers.org. Is that what it is?
That's right. That's there you it. Go.
Just, so yeah, check it out. I'm just checking it out right now. So Natalie, thanks for coming on the show. We're the best kept secret in the Bitcoin world, and at least the media version of Bitcoin. So you finally are exposed to us, and I'm very thankful you came on our show. Thank you so much.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Len.